A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hannah sent us this one. She's been watching a Turkish show called The Gift, or Atiye, which centers on Gerbikli Tepe as this mystical, magical portal site. And she's asking what we actually know about the place, who built it, what their lives were like, where they fit in the story of civilization. And the big question, would those Neolithic people have had a fundamentally different, more enchanted relationship with the cosmos than we do? That last one's the kind of thing archaeologists argue about over drinks.
It's a great question, because Göbekli Tepe does something to people. It's 11,600 years old. That's a number that sounds fake, but it's real. This thing was already buried and ancient when the first stones of Stonehenge were dragged into place. To put that in perspective, if you were standing at Göbekli Tepe when it was first built, the time between you and Stonehenge would be longer than the time between Stonehenge and us. That's how deep we're going. It predates pottery, writing, the wheel, metal tools of any kind. And yet you've got these massive T-shaped limestone pillars, some of them 5.5 meters tall, weighing up to 20 tons, arranged in circles, covered in carvings of foxes and snakes and scorpions and birds, built by people who did not farm. That's the headline.
No farming, no pottery, no metal. Just stone tools and a lot of coordination.
The site sits in southeastern Turkey near the Syrian border on a hilltop that overlooks the Harran Plain. It was first noted in a 1963 survey by the University of Chicago and Istanbul University, but the survey team saw some broken limestone slabs and dismissed it as a medieval cemetery. They missed it entirely. It sat there until 1994, when a German archaeologist named Klaus Schmidt was poking around the area, saw the same stones, and recognized the distinctive T-shape from his work at another Neolithic site called Nivalika Tori. He started excavating in 1995 with the German Archaeological Institute, and within a few seasons they realized they were looking at something that was going to rewrite the textbook.
A medieval cemetery. That's the equivalent of finding a parked car in the desert and assuming it's a 1992 Corolla.
A very fair analogy. And here's the thing, only about 5% of the site has been excavated as of now. There are at least 20 circular enclosures visible in ground-penetrating radar surveys, and only a handful have been fully uncovered. So everything we say about the site comes with the caveat that 95% of the story is still underground.
Let's start with the thing that makes everyone's head tilt. How do you quarry, transport, and erect a 20-ton stone pillar when you don't have wheels, you don't have draft animals, you don't have metal chisels? You've got flint tools, ropes made from plant fiber, and presumably a lot of people who are very tired.
The quarry is about 300 meters from the main enclosure, which sounds close until you realize it's uphill, and you're dragging something the weight of 4 adult elephants on wooden sledges across limestone bedrock. Experimental archaeology suggests a single pillar would require somewhere between 500 and 1,000 people to move. And that's just the transport. The pillars were carved from the bedrock using flint picks and stone hammers. They'd carve channels around the pillar to isolate it, then lever it free. There are partially quarried pillars still attached to the bedrock at the site. You can walk up and see exactly where they stopped working.
1,000 people, all coordinated, no written language, no apparent hierarchy. That's the part that bothers the standard model.
It really bothers the standard model. The textbook story of the Neolithic Revolution goes like this. Around 10,000 BCE, people in the Fertile Crescent started domesticating plants and animals. Agriculture creates food surpluses. Surpluses allow population growth and specialization. Some people can become priests, rulers, artisans. Specialization creates hierarchy. Hierarchy enables large-scale construction. Monuments are the end product of a long chain that starts with farming. Göbekli Tepe reverses the arrow. It suggests that large-scale ritual projects came first, and the need to feed the people building them may have actually driven the domestication of plants and animals.
The temples built the farms, not the other way around.
That was Klaus Schmidt's hypothesis, and it's still debated, but the chronology supports it. The earliest layers at Göbekli Tepe date to around 9600 BCE. The earliest known domesticated emmer wheat appears at Navalja Kachori, which is only about 30 kilometers away, around 9500 BCE, their contemporary. And at Göbekli Tepe itself, the animal bones found in the fill are all wild species. Gazelle, wild cattle, onager, wild boar. No domesticated animals. The grinding stones show evidence of wild cereals and nuts, almonds, pistachios, wild einkorn. These people were sophisticated foragers, not farmers. They knew plants intimately, they just hadn't crossed the line into full domestication.
When you say knew plants intimately, what does that actually look like in practice? How would a Neolithic forager relate to a wild wheat stand differently than a farmer relates to a domesticated field?
A farmer looks at a wheat field and sees a crop, a uniform resource to be harvested at the right time. A forager looks at a wild wheat stand and sees a complex community. Wild einkorn doesn't grow in neat monocultures. It's scattered among other grasses, herbs, and shrubs. The grains ripen at different times. The seed heads shatter easily. That's actually why domestication took so long, because the trait that makes wheat easy to harvest, a non-shattering rachis, is a mutation that foragers would have had to notice and selectively encourage over many generations. So a Neolithic forager is making dozens of micro-decisions every time they visit a stand. Which plants to harvest now? Which to leave for later? Which individual plants have slightly tougher seed heads that might be worth encouraging? They're not just taking from the landscape. They're reading it, managing it, nudging it in certain directions, all without the clean boundary we draw between farming and foraging.
It's less a line and more a gradient. These people were standing right on the threshold.
They were in what some archaeologists call the low-level food production zone, intensively managing wild resources without fully committing to domestication. And what's so interesting about Göbekli Tepe is that it suggests the commitment to domestication may have been driven by the demands of monument building, not the other way around. If you need to feed 1,000 people for a month-long construction event, you need reliable, storable, high-calorie food. Wild gazelle migrations are seasonal and unpredictable. A field of domesticated emmer wheat is something you can plan around.
What about daily life? Were people living at the site year-round?
That's one of the big interpretive shifts in recent years. Schmidt's original interpretation was that Göbekli Tepe was a purely ritual center, a temple, where people gathered periodically, but nobody lived permanently. No domestic structures, no hearths, no trash middens, but more recent excavations have complicated that picture. There's now evidence of large-scale food preparation. Enormous quantities of animal bones with cut marks, massive grinding installations, stone vessels that could hold hundreds of liters of liquid. And in the past few years, archaeologists have identified what look like residential structures at the site, not in the main enclosures, but in the surrounding areas. Lee Clare, who took over the excavations after Schmidt died in 2014, has been pushing a reinterpretation. He argues Göbekli Tepe may have been a settlement after all, a permanent or semi-permanent community that included both domestic and ritual spaces.
The world's first temple. Framing might be oversold.
It's definitely oversold. Ritual center with residential components is probably closer to the current consensus. But the ritual component is real and significant. The T-shaped pillars, and this is one of the most striking things about the site. Some of them have carved arms, hands, and what appear to be loincloths. They seem to represent human figures or perhaps human-like beings. They're not just abstract architecture. They're representations, possibly of ancestors or spirit figures. And then there are the skulls.
The skull cult.
3 human skull fragments were found at the site with deep incised grooves cut into them. These weren't accidental marks. Someone deliberately carved channels into human skulls, possibly for suspension, hanging them from cords, or for some kind of ritual display. This connects to a broader pattern in the pre-pottery Neolithic across the region. At Jericho, you get plastered skulls with shells in the eye sockets. At Satohuyuk, skulls are found under house floors. There's something going on with ancestor veneration, or possibly trophy display, we don't know which. But heads matter to these people in a way that's hard for us to access.
Like keeping your grandmother's ashes on the mantle, but several steps more intense.
Several steps more intense, yes. But let me push on that analogy because it might actually be even stranger than that. When we keep ashes on the mantle, we're keeping a memory. The person is gone, and the ashes are a symbol. when someone at Neolithic Jericho plastered a skull, rebuilt the face with clay, and set shells into the eye sockets, they were doing something different. They were keeping the person present. The skull wasn't a symbol of the ancestor. It was the ancestor, still participating in the life of the household. People at Çatalhöyük buried their dead under the floors of their houses and then continued living on top of them. The dead weren't sent away to a cemetery. They were integrated into daily space. It's a completely different metaphysics of what a person is and where they go after death.
The boundary between living and dead was more permeable.
Much more permeable. And that's going to matter when we get to Hannah's question about enchantment. But first, the animal carvings on the pillars. Foxes, snakes, scorpions, spiders, cranes, wild boars, aurochs. They're not random decoration. They're carefully placed, often in specific relationships to each other. Some enclosures are dominated by particular animals. Enclosure C has a lot of boar imagery. Enclosure D is heavy on foxes and snakes. There's a theory that different enclosures may have been associated with different groups, maybe different clans or lineages that gathered at the site periodically, each with their own animal emblem.
You'd have your fox clan enclosure, your snake clan enclosure, and everyone converges on the hill for the big seasonal feast.
That's one model. The feasting evidence is strong. The animal bone deposits suggest periodic, high-intensity consumption events, not daily household meals. Gazelle were being slaughtered in huge numbers during specific seasons, probably when migratory herds were passing through. It looks like Göbekli Tepe was a gathering place where dispersed hunter-gatherer groups came together at certain times of year, pooled their labor, built these incredible structures, and probably engaged in rituals we can only guess at. And then, around 8000 BCE, after roughly 1600 years of use, they buried it. The enclosures were backfilled with debris, broken stone tools, animal bones, flint flakes, limestone rubble, and in some cases human remains. This wasn't natural siltation or gradual abandonment. Someone made a conscious decision to fill in these structures and seal them. The fill preserved the pillars perfectly for over 10,000 years. Without that burial, they'd have eroded away like any other exposed limestone. The act of burial is itself a puzzle. Was it a decommissioning ritual? A closing ceremony? Did something change in the society that made these spaces no longer appropriate? Was it an act of protection or an act of rejection?
It's hard not to read it as an ending. A way of organizing society that had worked for 16 centuries stopped working.
That's where the big implications kick in. 1600 years is longer than any modern nation-state has existed. The Roman Empire lasted about that long, if you're generous with the dating. Göbekli Tepe represents a stable, large-scale, non-hierarchical, or at least not obviously hierarchical, form of social organization that endured for millennia. And then it was deliberately closed, and the people of the region shifted toward agriculture, settled villages, and eventually the kind of stratified societies that would produce cities, kings, and written records.
Which brings us to Hannah's bigger question. The gift portrays Göbekli Tepe as a place of cosmic portals and shamanic visions and hidden knowledge. It's fiction. But is there something to the idea that these people experience the world as more enchanted than we do?
I want to be careful with this, because it's easy to slide into romantic projection. The noble savage who's more spiritually pure than us, jaded moderns, that's a colonial fantasy with a long and not great history. But there's also a genuine anthropological question here. If you look at contemporary hunter-gatherer groups, the Hadza in Tanzania, the San in southern Africa, various Amazonian peoples, they tend to have what anthropologists call animistic worldviews. The world is full of beings with agency and intention. Animals are not resources, they're other persons with whom you're in relationship. The landscape is alive. Dreams are real experiences, not just brain noise. Causality is personal. If something bad happens, someone or something caused it.
Which is not the same as being mystical in the New Age sense. It's a practical epistemology for people whose survival depends on reading animal behavior and landscape cues with extreme precision.
If you're tracking a wounded gazelle across the savanna, treating the gazelle as an agent with intentions and strategies is not superstition. It's good hunting practice. If you're gathering wild plants across a landscape that you navigate without maps, treating landmarks as meaningful and alive helps you remember them. The mysticism of hunter-gatherers is not fluffy spirituality. It's a survival toolkit encoded in metaphor and narrative. And the people who built Göbekli Tepe were, in many ways, cognitively modern humans. Their brains were the same size as ours. They had language, they had symbolic thought, they had complex social relationships. They weren't less intelligent than us, they just lived in a different information environment.
Would a builder at Göbekli Tepe have experienced the night sky differently than I do?
And here's where the astronomy question gets interesting. There's been a lot of speculative work trying to link Göbekli Tepe's carvings to celestial events. The most famous example is the so-called Vulture Stone, Pillar 43 in Enclosure D. It shows a vulture with outstretched wings, a scorpion, and several other animals. Some researchers, notably Martin Sweatman at the University of Edinburgh, have argued that this pillar is a date stamp. It records a comet impact or a meteor shower that occurred around 10,950 BCE, at the onset of the Younger Dryas cooling period. The animals are claimed to represent constellations, and their arrangement encodes the position of the sun and stars at that moment.
Mainstream archaeology is...
Mainstream archaeology is deeply skeptical. The constellation interpretation requires a lot of post hoc pattern matching. You can find alignments in any sufficiently complex set of symbols if you look hard enough. The animals on the pillars don't consistently match the constellations they're claimed to represent across different enclosures. And the comet impact hypothesis itself is controversial. There's evidence for it, but it's not the consensus view of the Younger Dryas onset. Lee Clare has been pretty blunt about this. He says there's no convincing evidence for astronomical alignments at Göbekli Tepe, and the carvings are better understood as symbolic representations of the natural world the builders inhabited, not a star chart.
The Vulture Stone is probably not a Neolithic planetarium.
But here's the thing. Even without astronomical alignments, these people would have had a profoundly different relationship with the night sky than we do. No light pollution. No artificial light of any kind except fire. The Milky Way would have been a dominant feature of every clear night. The lunar cycle would have been central to timekeeping. The movements of stars and planets would have been visible, trackable, and probably meaningful in ways we can barely access. You don't need a star chart carved in stone to have a deep relationship with the cosmos. You just need to live your whole life outdoors, with the sky as your ceiling.
There's a difference between being an astronomer and being sky aware. I've been to places with zero light pollution, and the experience is genuinely disorienting. The sky looks wrong. Too many stars. You feel exposed.
That's exactly the point. For a Neolithic person, that exposed feeling wouldn't exist. It would just be normal. The sky would be as familiar as the ground. The idea that the stars are distant balls of burning gas would be incomprehensible. Not because they're stupid, but because that's not a useful way to relate to something that's part of your daily environment. When you're living in a world where everything has agency, animals, weather, rivers, seasons, the stars probably have agency too. That's not mysticism. That's a coherent worldview that worked perfectly well for tens of thousands of years.
I want to pause on that word agency for a second, because I think it's easy to misunderstand. When you say the stars have agency, you're not saying Neolithic people thought the stars were literally making decisions the way a person does. You're saying they related to the stars as something you're in relationship with, rather than something you observe from a distance.
Yes, that's exactly the distinction. It's the difference between an I-it relationship and an I-thou relationship, to borrow Martin Buber's language. A modern astronomer relates to a star as an it, an object with properties to be measured. A Neolithic person relates to a star as a thou, a presence with which you have an ongoing relationship. That doesn't mean they thought the star was a person with a name and a personality. It means the star was part of the social world, not the mechanical world. When the Pleiades rise at a certain time of year, that's not just an astronomical fact, it's a communication. It means something about the season, about the behavior of animals, about what the community should be doing. The star is participating in the same web of meaning that you're participating in.
The GIF dramatizes it as portals and visions, which is good television, but the reality might be more interesting. These people didn't need portals because they already lived in a world that was fully alive and communicative. The fox on the pillar isn't a symbol of a fox. It's the fox, present in the stone.
That's a very corny way of putting it, and I think it's probably close to the mark. One of the things that's striking about the animal carvings is that they're not generic, they're specific. The foxes have distinctive features. The snakes are coiled in particular ways. These are abstract icons. They're depictions of real animals the carvers knew intimately. And they're placed on pillars that may represent ancestors or spirit beings. You've got this layering of meaning where the stone is both a person and a surface for depicting other persons. It's dense with relationality.
Does Göbekli Tepe tell us anything about how we should organize ourselves today? Or is that just another projection?
I think it offers a useful provocation, even if we shouldn't draw direct lessons. The standard story of human history is that hierarchy is inevitable. You get agriculture, you get surplus, you get inequality, you get kings. It's a one-way ratchet. Göbekli Tepe suggests that large-scale cooperation is possible without top-down authority. 1,000 people dragging a 20-ton pillar up a hill, not because a king ordered them to, but because they shared a belief system that made that labor meaningful. That's a different kind of motivation than coercion or economic incentive.
It's the open-source software model of monument building. Nobody pays you to contribute to a project. You do it because you believe in it, because your identity is tied to it, because the community values it.
That's not a bad analogy. And it connects to something David Graeber and David Wingrow argue in The Dawn of Everything, that early human societies were politically creative in ways we've underestimated. They experimented with different forms of organization. Seasonal shifts between hierarchy and egalitarianism, rotating leadership, consensus-based decision-making. Göbekli Tepe might represent one of those experiments, sustained over an extraordinarily long period.
The seasonal shift thing is fascinating. You're saying the same group of people might be egalitarian hunter-gatherers for part of the year, and then gather into a more hierarchical structure for the big ritual season.
That's exactly the kind of flexibility Graeber and Wengrow document, and it makes intuitive sense. If you're dispersed across the landscape in small bands for most of the year, tracking game and harvesting wild plants, you don't need a chief. Decisions are made by consensus because everyone's face-to-face and the stakes are immediate. But when you converge on a ritual center with 1,000 people from different bands, you need some kind of coordination structure. Maybe certain lineages take leadership roles during the gathering. Maybe there are ritual specialists who direct the construction. But the key is that the hierarchy is temporary and situational. It doesn't harden into a permanent class structure. When the gathering ends, everyone disperses back to their bands, and the chiefs go back to being just another hunter.
Then it ended. They buried it. The experiment stopped.
We don't know why. Maybe agriculture made hierarchy too tempting to resist. Once you've got stored grain, someone controls the grain. Once someone controls the grain, you've got a lever for power. The ritual centers of the Tau Tepala region, that's the broader archaeological landscape around Göbekli Tepe, were all abandoned or transformed around the same time, roughly 8,000 BCE. After that, you get the rise of large settled villages like Tatalhöyük, which are fascinating in their own right, but represent a different kind of social organization, more domestic, less monumental. And then eventually you get cities, states, empires, the whole apparatus of civilization.
If I'm hearing you right, the mystical framing in the gift isn't entirely wrong. It's just aimed at the wrong target. The builders of Göbekli Tepe probably did experience the world as enchanted, full of meaning and agency. But it wasn't a secret portal to another dimension. It was a practical, embodied way of being in the world that made sense for people whose survival depended on deep attunement to their environment.
And the site itself is wondrous without needing to add cosmic portals. 11,600 years ago, people who hunted wild game with flint-tipped spears got together on a hilltop in Anatolia and built something that still stands. They carved their world into stone. The animals they hunted, the ancestors they remembered, the relationships that held their society together. They did this for 16 centuries, without kings or metal tools or written language. And then they carefully buried it, preserving it for us to find and puzzle over.
The burial might be the most interesting part. They didn't destroy it. They didn't abandon it to the elements. They filled it in, with care, including objects that seem to have been deliberately placed. It's like they were putting something to sleep.
There's a respect in that act that's hard to interpret. If you're overthrowing a hated priesthood, you smash the idols. If you're closing a sacred space because its time has passed, you might bury it with ceremony. The fact that the pillars were preserved intact suggests the burial wasn't an act of destruction. It was an act of closure.
I keep thinking about what it would feel like to be part of that burial. You're filling in a space that your great-great-great-grandparents built. You've probably heard stories about the gatherings, the feasts, the rituals. But you've never experienced them in the same way. The world has changed. You're maybe growing some of your own food now. You live in a village. And you're shoveling rubble into these ancient enclosures, knowing you're the last generation to touch them.
That's a poignant image, and it raises a question about cultural memory. 1600 years is a very long time. How much did the people who buried Göbekli Tepe actually know about what happened there? Were they preserving living traditions, or were they dealing with something that was already mysterious to them? We know that oral traditions can preserve information across millennia. Australian Aboriginal oral histories appear to reference sea level rise events from over 7,000 years ago. So it's possible that the people who buried Göbekli Tepe had stories about its origins and understood its significance. But it's also possible that the meaning had shifted over generations, and the burial was as much about managing an increasingly incomprehensible legacy as it was about honoring a tradition.
Now we've dug it back up, which raises its own questions.
One of the ongoing tensions at the site is between preservation and excavation. The pillars were preserved by being buried. Now that they're exposed to air and weather, they're degrading. The site has a tension membrane roof over it now, and there are conservation teams working to stabilize the stone, but every season of excavation exposes more material to the elements. There's a real debate about whether to continue digging or to leave the remaining 95% underground for future archaeologists with better techniques.
Leave it for the robots.
Ground-penetrating radar and LIDAR are getting better every year. In 20 years, we might be able to map the entire site without disturbing a single stone.
Where does this leave Hannah's question? What should someone take away from all this, beyond the basic wonder of it?
A few things. First, if you want to engage with Göbekli Tepe directly, there are good resources. The Göbekli Tepe Museum opened in 2023 in Yanlarfa, about 15 kilometers from the site. It has a full-scale reconstruction of Enclosure D and excellent interpretive materials. The German Archaeological Institute has a digital reconstruction online that you can explore. And for reading, Klaus Schmidt's book, Göbekli Tepe, a Stone Age Sanctuary in Southeastern Anatolia, is still the foundational text, even though some interpretations have shifted since his death.
The gift is fun. It's fiction. It's not a documentary.
It's absolutely fun. And I'd say watch it, enjoy the drama, but know that the real site is more interesting than the fictional version. The real mystery isn't a cosmic portal. It's how a group of hunter-gatherers organized themselves to build something that would last 12,000 years, and what that tells us about human possibility.
The mystery is us. It's always us.
One more thing. Göbekli Tepe isn't alone. The Tau Tepeler region, which means stone hills in Turkish, includes at least a dozen similar sites that are now being excavated. Karahan Tepe, discovered in 1997 and excavated since 2019, has T-shaped pillars and enclosures that are in some ways even more elaborate than Göbekli Tepe. There's a whole network of these ritual centers across the region, and we've barely begun to understand how they were connected.
The story isn't finished. It's barely started.
That's the most exciting part. Everything we've said today might look different in 10 years, when another 5% of the site is excavated, or when Karahan Tepe yields something we didn't expect. The Neolithic is not a closed book. It's an ongoing investigation, and Göbekli Tepe is the site that keeps reminding us how much we don't know.
Which brings us to the open question. If Göbekli Tepe represents a failed experiment in non-hierarchical complex society, it was abandoned and buried, after all. What does that say about the inevitability of hierarchy? Is it a failure, or is a 1600-year run a success that we should be envious of?
That's the question I keep coming back to. 1600 years of cooperation without kings, and then they chose to end it. Not collapse, not conquest. A deliberate closing. Maybe the lesson isn't that hierarchy is inevitable. Maybe the lesson is that different forms of social organization are appropriate for different times and circumstances. The people who buried Göbekli Tepe might have been making a rational decision. This way of life has run its course. Let's try something else.
Then they walked down the hill and invented farming.
More or less. The Neolithic Revolution didn't happen to passive people who were dragged into history. They made choices. Göbekli Tepe is evidence that those choices were more creative and more deliberate than we usually give them credit for.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The word clockwise originally referred to the direction a sundial shadow moves in the Northern Hemisphere, but in New Zealand's South Island, the first mechanical clocks installed by European settlers in the 1850s occasionally had their gears reversed to match the Southern Hemisphere sundial direction, creating what locals briefly called southernwise timekeeping before standardization won out.
I don't know what to do with that.
It's got a certain charm.
This has been my weird prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We're at myweirdprompts.com for past episodes and transcripts. Our producer is Hilbert Flemingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.